The trouble with research is it tells you what people are thinking about yesterday. It's like driving a car using a rearview mirror. So said Bernard Loomis, the toy developer who introduced Barbie to the world. Meanwhile, Ralph W. Sockman argued that the larger the island of knowledge, the longer the shoreline of wonder. On this History of Advertising podcast, we'll be covering both sides of the argument as we take a look at the role which research has played in advertising. Jeremy Bullmore is an Adland giant whose writing is considered essential reading for all students of the theory and practice of advertising. His high opinion of research is hardly surprising, given the fact that earlier in his career, he played a key role at JWT, an ad agency which led the way when it came to integrating research into campaigns.
I was never in the position of one who believed that research killed creativity. I mean, I've always found research fascinating and stimulating, and even when you disagree with it, you have to work out why you disagree with it.
The late, great Judy Lannan was appointed by JWT in 1968, and shortly afterwards she established its consumer research department. Here, she recalls the initial flaws in the premise of advertising research.
I always knew there was something not quite right about what I was being taught, but I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what it was at all. The premise was something called the AIDA model, called Attention, Interest, Desire, Action. And the assumption that an ad had to grab attention, interest you, develop a desire, and then action would follow. And there was a logical sequence to this, which placed an enormous emphasis on attention. Hence the ghastly quantity of shouty American ads that not only are usually at a high pitch, but repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat. It was like a hammer, you know, pounding a nail into your head. But all of that stemmed from this assumption that that is how advertising worked. And so the whole culture of American advertising for years, and still does to some extent, stem from this mistaken assumption that this is the way advertising works.
We asked Judy what she thought her mission was when going into the field of reforming advertising research techniques.
Well, I think the first thing was to debunk the obsession with attention. That was quite critical, because 24-hour recall was the standard way of measuring advertising, and everybody knew that was wrong, but clients didn't. The measurement was wrong in that it really didn't lead to anything behavioral change. But the other thing, which is quite important, was that the ad had already been made, and there was no predictive way. That was the other thing, the holy grail that was being looked for, was a predictive advertising test.
A predictive research model, one which tells clients and ad agencies with certainty whether their ads are going to be successful, didn't exist, and probably never will. Just in the same way that we will never be able to predict with certainty what's going to be the next bestseller or the top TV show. However, this doesn't mean that the research model hasn't evolved beyond simple attention and recall studies. Judy tells us about the importance that creative development research can play in maximizing an ad campaign's success.
It is a waste of money, time, and effort to try to find something that predicts the future, which you can't, or to measure something once it's already made. And then if you're going to make a strategic decision about how to use your research money, better you should use it before the ad's made, hence the whole idea of the creative development research, which is what I had been taught, is to understand the target group most of all and what they believed and thought about the various brands in the market or the various products, whatever they were in the market, and then try to develop advertising with that kind of an input. And then we also used, storyboards and animatics and all manner of rough material to do that, so that there was an important, the thinking was important in the sense that it was a more useful, helpful way of using your research money before rather than after the thing had been made.
The improved research model, spearheaded by Judy, Jeremy, and many others, sought to establish a stronger link between how the ads were made in the first place and how they were measured after they ran.
It was an extremely coherent, I'd call it a philosophy, it was a philosophy and a thinking procedure that went from understanding what the problem was and how the problem got to be that way and how could it be solved and what was required in order to solve it. Was it something that advertising could do or not do, whether it was a product problem that had to be, that had nothing to do with advertising? And then having run for a while, and then there were decisions to be made about the weight of the advertising and how long it should run, has it had the desired effect? So it set up a series of objectives and a way of intellectually getting to some kind of a solution that it was a measurable solution about how the advertising had performed in the marketplace.
Judy's research played a pivotal role in the campaigns rolled out for many brands. For instance, her research showed the Persil team how to combat the new threat from Ariel in the 60s, and it encouraged the creative team working on After Eight to scrap plans to spoof their own successful dinner party campaign. Now it's time to turn over to the other side of the coin, as we look at how research was ignored during the creation of one of the most successful lines in a beer campaign from the 20th century.
Heineken refreshes the parts what other beers cannot reach.
Sir Frank Lowe was the account man handling Heineken's advertising in the 70s. He recalls how difficult it was for creative Terry Lovelock to find the right line in the first place.
So Terry had been working for 4 months on this campaign, and I'd rejected ad after ad after campaign after campaign. And I remember at one point I was getting so frustrated, and I bumped into Terry. I was getting in the lift and he was getting in, and I said, Terry, whatever you do, come back with a campaign that's about a new way of thinking about refreshment. That's the strategy. So off he went. And he actually went to Africa on a photographic shoot for Ford. And I was furious. I said, where's Terry? They said he's in Africa, staying at the Mamunia, no less. He'd gone there, and I got hold of British Airways, got through to the lounge where he was sitting, got hold of him, Terry. You're not supposed to be there. You're running away and hiding. I know what you're up to. And if you don't come back with a campaign, don't come back. Now, of course, I didn't mean it, but I was really worried. 4 months, no ad. Terry did come back with a few lines. And one line was, Heineken refreshes the parts other beers cannot reach.
Even now, the line remains familiar to many people who grew up watching the ads. Frank recalls how daring it was at the time and the initial difficulty he faced in convincing the client to go ahead with it.
In those days, to write something like that was extraordinary. And he said, well, I said, I think it'll work. He said, well, go ahead, but I think we'd better do some research. I said, we don't like research, Tony, because it'll kill it. He said, well, just do me a few groups, will you? So I did the groups, and I still have the results of the groups. And it came back, and I remember the end paragraph of the groups, the summary. It said, in the belief of the groups, this campaign is completely incomprehensible and will never have any success selling Heineken beer. So I showed it to Tony. He said, what are we going to do? I said, well, let's run it anyway. He said, go ahead. Now, I don't know whether people would do that today. I mean, such courage. And it ran for, I don't know, 25 years, and it built Heineken into the biggest selling brand of beer in Britain.
The water in Mallorca doesn't taste like what it ought to.
No, no. The water in Mallorca don't taste like what it ought to.
The water in Mallorca doesn't taste quite how it should.
Mallorca.
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 Oi, Dale, any danger of some refreshment in here?
Here you are. Get your laughing gear in there.
Oh, golly. The water in Mallorca...
What's that?
...don't taste like what it ought to. Gosh. The water in Mallorca don't taste like what it ought to.
She's cracked. She's only cracked.
You're absolutely wrong.
Heineken refreshes the parts what other beers cannot reach.
Frank is not a fan of research because he believes that people seeing ads for the first time are often prejudiced against new ideas.
People, by and large, don't like what they are unfamiliar with. If you take how many people turned down the Beatles, God knows, because they hadn't heard it. How well was the Impressionist movement received when it came out? And so I've come to the view that anything was really different, really new, while being initially confusing and perhaps not liked, in the end, if it was good enough, people would come to like it.
So, a comprehensive research model, one which goes beyond a simple attention matrix, can prove a valuable tool in helping build a campaign, as well as monitor its effectiveness. But research should only be used as a guide, and one should always be wary of the fact that people are often resistant to new ideas when showed them for the first time. This episode of the History of Advertising podcast was presented by Jack Meggett Phillips and featured contributions from Jeremy Bullmore, Judy Lannan, and Sir Frank Lowe. The programme was produced by Jane Jarvis and Jack Meggett Phillips. To find out more about the adverts featured on this programme, please go to hatads.org.uk.